Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. For-profit and private ITT Technical Institute closed its doors across the country for good last week. The move came about 2 weeks after the Department of Education barred the parent company from enrolling new students using federal financial aid funds. Government officials said the company was on shaky financial ground and on the brink of losing its accreditation. Now ITT's 45,000 enrolled students have to decide whether to transfer their credits or have their existing loans forgiven. We're talking about what the fallout means for other private nonprofit schools in the U.S. and their students. Coming up, we'll hear from the former Dean of Academic Affairs for the ITT Technical Institute, Columbus Eastside Campus. Joining us now is the Director of Federal Relations and Policy Analysis at the American Association of State Colleges and Universities, Barmak Nasirian. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us, education policy professor at Pennsylvania State University and an expert in for-profit education, Kevin Kinzer. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ann.
Kevin Kinzer, when did this heightened government scrutiny of for-profit colleges get started?
Well, it really started with the first Obama administration. They were in the process of implementing the Higher Education Act reauthorization. And at that point decided to focus on certain language in that act that could be directed towards for-profit institutions, in particular looking at language around gainful employment, around incentive compensation, different catchphrases that are part of the legislative agenda that, from a regulatory perspective, the department decided to focus their attention on.
Yeah, what triggered this heightened interest?
Well, the size of the for-profit sector, it grew enormously during the 2000s. It started out, you know, relatively small, almost like a rounding error, and people wouldn't pay much attention to it. But suddenly it became this huge behemoth. You started seeing these large national public traded corporation establishing campuses across the country, advertising in droves. You couldn't ignore it anymore. And there was attention being paid to whether or not these institutions were actually doing a good job educating students, whether the growth was justified, whether they were adequately serving the students they had before adding 10, 20, 30,000 more students.
Did something change in the 2000s to spur this growth?
Well, there were two things that changed. One was the incentive compensation rules that I mentioned before. Mm-hmm. For-profits had been prohibited from paying their recruiters based on the number of students that came in. George W. Bush administration put in what were called safe harbors that opened up 12 different avenues that they could pay recruiters based on the number of students that came in. And those safe harbors allowed institutions to really focus on driving enrollment higher. The second thing that happened was online learning became widely eligible for financial aid. There used to be a rule that said that if you offered more than 50% of your program online, you weren't eligible for federal financial aid. That rule was eliminated in 2006. So the combination of these two things meant that institutions had very strong incentives to grow their enrollment and were no longer restricted by infrastructure constraints in building their enrollment to really great heights.
Barmak Nasirian, from where you sit with the American Association of State Colleges and Universities, did you notice a change in where students were going and what was happening with them?
Oh, absolutely. And indeed, we anticipated the change. When the so-called 50% rule that Kevin just referenced was being repealed, and by the way, it was repealed with no hearings, no record, it was just done overnight in a reconciliation bill. But when that provision was being repealed, traditional higher ed very clearly warned Congress that what they were doing was removing one of the most important safeguards against fraud. So yes, indeed, we saw the size of enrollments balloon, and even more ubiquitous than that was the share of federal dollars that were going into the for-profit sector.
First of all, everyone, you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about the history behind the growth of the private for-profit education industry in the United States. It really took off in the 2000s when rules and regulations regarding how they could attract students, how they could recruit students, and also how those students could pay for school changed. You just heard from Barmak Nasirian. He is the Director of Federal Relations and Policy Analysis at the American Association of State Colleges and Universities, and also Kevin Kinzer. He's an education policy expert at Pennsylvania State University. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, Barmak Nasirian, why did the George W. Bush administration think it was important to relax these rules and regulations and create these safe harbors?
So there are two answers depending on how cynical someone wants to be. The easy answer is to point out that these are organizations that put disproportionate resources into lobbying. And, you know, I got news for you. Lobbying works. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you spend enough, Congress may pass a law that says toxic sludge is good for you. So that's the cynical explanation. Now, there is a more substantive element here as well, just to be fair to the other side, and that is that policymakers are terrified of ever-escalating costs of real higher education and are therefore very susceptible to snake oil pitches that suggest there's a new magical way to make things hang together for everybody. And the invocation of the Internet provided a perfect opportunity for fraudsters to basically come in and suggest that they could do a whole lot more if only this little inconvenient rule that banned full utilization of distance ed were to be removed.
Kevin Kinzer, was there any research at the time to show that these schools could achieve the goals that they promised to Congress and the president?
Right. Well, just to follow up what Barmak said, mm-hmm. I think that we have to remember that the ever since the modern federal financial aid system was established in the 1970s and 80s, we've had access as being the primary goal. We want to make sure that more and more students have the opportunity to go to college. And so these were institutions that were saying, hey, look, we're not these stodgy traditional institutions that have, you know, restrictive admission policies and are only interested in faculty research. We're here for the student. We're here for career training, and we're here directed to helping students make advances personally. We're about the students, in other words. Those are the claims that they were making, and that fit very nicely into the sort of the sense of society at the time that you should go to college. College was necessary back in Bill Clinton's era, that the idea of we should make the first 2 years of college just as accessible as the first 12 years of schooling in elementary and high schools. So there was an access argument that was being made as well. At the same time, the research about their success, we've gone through this before. For-profits have been around for a while, and it seems like about every 20 years there's a new scandal about what for-profits are doing in different ways of gaming the system, getting resources, and not providing quality of education. It goes back to World War II when fly-by-night providers took advantage of the original GI Bill. Mm-hmm. So this isn't a new story for us. It's one that we keep revisiting because the policies involved are so complex and the interest groups are so strong.
So on two levels, they're giving students who can't get into stodgy old places like maybe Pennsylvania State University, and also they're geared toward job acquisition, right? They're training directly for jobs. Kevin Kinzer, and the big universities, the places, the traditional universities don't tend to do that.
Right. Well, that's the rhetoric, of course. The rhetoric is that we're here for the student and we're directly training students for jobs. But what some of the investigations were showing, particularly the investigation led by Senator Harkin in the Senate from 2010 to 2012, was that a lot of the claims about job training really simply didn't hold up to scrutiny, that they were not, in fact, training students for jobs as nearly as efficiently as they were claiming, partly because a lot of students weren't completing the programs. They had an enormous amount of dropouts associated with their programs. they kept growing, of course, because they were enrolling many new students. So one student drops out, two new students enroll, and it looks like you're a successful institution, when in fact you really haven't been educating the students that you bring in very well at all.
How much in federal loans and grants goes to private for-profit schools? Do either of you know what percentage or what hard numbers?
Sure. It's about 21% of total. You're looking at about $100 billion in aggregate. So about 21% of both loans and grants go to the sector as of the most recent national statistics.
And is that proportional?
No, absolutely. You mean proportional to enrollment?
Yeah.
No, absolutely not. It's quite disproportional because they combine the worst of all possible worlds. You know, on the one hand, they precisely because they specifically target low-income students, they have the highest eligibility. The population has the highest eligibility, and at the same time, they combine that with a very peculiar attribute, which is extremely high cost. So the delta for their population is much greater. And consequently, they receive about twice the dollar amount from the total pool than their enrollment percentage.
All right. So the loss of those loans and grants, when the federal government cracked down on that and said, you can't recruit using those federal loans and grants, it effectively shuts down ITT, right? Is that what did it?
Well, you know, it's an interesting and debatable issue,
uh-huh.
And there's a real odd way in which the narrative of the defenders of the sector and the department's own sort of presentation are sort of merging here. The department has an interest in looking like it's a tough sheriff on the job and is sort of, you know, taking care of business. And, of course, the defenders of the sector likewise would like to suggest that ITT was a perfectly healthy institution that was shut down by a department that is on some kind of a vendetta, allegedly. Mm-hmm. In reality, the way I describe it is you shouldn't blame the undertaker for the fact that your loved one is deceased. You know, ITT was financially, academically, and legally in trouble and was as an institution. It was simply unsustainable. The department had to pull the trigger at some point, and I would argue that they were a number of years late, that they constantly confronted this challenge of too big to fail, and they kept rolling the dice despite the fact that there were multiple triggers dating at the very least back 2 years when they should have stepped in much more decisively to contain the damage.
So, Kevin Kinzer, are there others like ITT out there? I know that there was another school company that shut down last year. Are there a lot of others out there like ITT?
Yeah, you're referring to Corinthian Colleges, which
yes.
was the first big for-profit institution to shut down. ITT is the second. There are questions about others, such as one that's called EDMC, which runs Argosy University, the art institutes, as another one that people are looking at as possibly being in difficulty. A lot of the major national publicly traded for-profit institutions have a lot of difficulties associated with their operation. And I think that's really the distinction that I want to make. A lot of the issues that we're pointing to are with these institutions that are being run as financial institutions. So they're being run by investors, for investors, with the intent of having a return on investment. There are a lot of other for-profit institutions that have very long histories in their communities, which are being swept up in this same mix simply because they operate in a for-profit model. Unfortunately, we have these very, very large and dominant providers that are setting the tone for everybody else. And I think that's the focus that the department is now looking at to try to say, okay, how do we get a handle on this model, this organizational model, which I think is demonstrated to be a pretty risky way of providing higher education from a public policy perspective.
We're talking about the history and the record of private nonprofit colleges and universities in the United States. So far, we know they take up about 21% of the loans and grants offered by the federal government far out of whack with the number of students that they educate. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll continue our conversation. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. For-profit and private ITT technical institutes closed their doors across the country for good last week. The move came after about 2 weeks after the Department of Education barred the parent company from enrolling new students using federal financial aid funds. Government officials said the company was on shaky financial ground and on the brink of losing its accreditation. Still with us is the Director of Federal Relations and Policy Analysis at the American Association of State Colleges and Universities, Barmak Nasirian, also education policy professor at Penn State University and an expert in for-profit education, Kevin Kinzer. Barmak Nasirian, you've said that people are defaulting at a rate of 2 per minute, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week on their loans used to attend these private for-profits. First of all, how does that compare and contrast with public nonprofits? Because we know there's a huge issue with this across the board, right?
There are issues with student loan defaults across the board, but in no sector is it more problematic than in the for-profit sector. They and community colleges, interestingly enough, tend to you have a significantly higher probability of default in those two sectors, but there's an enormous difference between defaults in the for-profit sector and defaults in the community college sector, because community colleges don't cost a lot of money. To the extent that there is borrowing, that borrowing is for subsistence. It tends to be significantly lower amounts. In fact, ironically, lower amounts.
Why do you say that?
Well, in the sense that, you know, it's sort of counterintuitive to believe that people end up, because as you know, default is a really consequential financial event. It really hounds you for life. So the notion that you can trigger a binary event like default over a relatively small amount of money, $3,000, $2,500, is counterintuitive. But that tends to characterize the rates within the community college system are high, but the number of borrowers that form the base of that rate is much smaller.
Okay.
The dollar amounts are much smaller. In the for-profit sector, people are defaulting on tens of thousands of dollars. So it's a real significant issue there.
Right, because a higher percentage of them, a vast majority of them, are borrowing a lot more money.
They're borrowing a lot more money. And by the way, defaults are in no way an accurate picture of economic reality, because, of course, the interest groups have manipulated the definitions to only count those economic defaults that occur within a very narrow window. So if you look at lifetime default, you'll see that that nearly half of all defaulters are generated by the student loan, by the for-profit sector.
It's been compared to this whole thing to the mortgage meltdown in terms of the recruitment practices, and I was wondering, Kevin Kinzer, can you talk about that? I mean, how did that work? In what way?
Well, what they were trying to do is to get students enrolled by whatever means they could, and this is based on some of the evidence that came out in the Harkin report and other sort of investigations that occurred. They would go to places and really push very hard to students to say, this is a way that you can make your life different. Find out ways, the quote is, find out ways of identifying where their pain is and arguing that enrolling in the for-profit institution would solve all their problems and make it better. But I think what Barmark is pointing out with the defaults is what you had is you had students that were already on the financial edge. These were students that were looking desperate for a way of getting out from under whatever problems that they had in terms of their employment, their finances, life skills. And you were putting them in even greater financial risk by making them sign up for tens of thousands of dollars of loans. You were putting them in programs where they're more likely to drop out anyway. It's no wonder that we would have these students that were at risk to begin with, at enrolling in risky programs and ending up having a more devastating outcome as part of it. We used to have an idea here that taking out student loans was a good risk, was something, was good debt to have because it would benefit you in the long run. What we're seeing with many of these for-profit programs, you actually end up in worse shape than you were before you started.
Likewise, the American dream of owning your own home, same kind of a parallel construction there. But
well, except with that, you can't foreclose on an education, right? There's actually an asset that the bank can repossess when it comes to a home. You can't repossess the knowledge. So the students are on the hook for this for the rest of their lives because this is the system that we have set up. They can't get it. It's very difficult, almost impossible to get it relieved during bankruptcy.
That's right. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the for-profit private education industry today. As you may have heard, ITT Institutes has shuttered across the country, casting tens of thousands of students kind of to the wolves right now. There are some organizations and schools that are working to try to resettle them elsewhere or help them settle their loans. We're going to be talking about that coming up in our next segment. Right now, I'm talking with, you just heard from Kevin Kinzer. He's an education policy professor at Pennsylvania State University and also an expert in for-profit education. And also with us, Barmak Nasirian. He's the director of federal relations and policy analysis at the American Association of State Colleges and Universities. Dan in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Dan, welcome to the show.
All right, thank you. So my first question is, because of what the institutions are doing, if I was a student and I say, hey, I applied, I got out this loan, and now I can't get my education, you're defaulted, can I turn around and now sue for fraud based on what they've done?
Is there standing there, Kevin or Barmak, do you know?
Sure. I mean, there are various legal options available, but obviously you have multiple issues, not least of all that attributing causality is very difficult. It's just as easy. I mean, think about this. This is a student who took a run at education. They failed. There's already a stigma associated with that, particularly if they're in default. And for them to attempt to take on a multi-billion-dollar corporation with you know all kinds of legal resources has proven very difficult. There have been class action lawsuits, but the great difficulty here is that those cases where you have the most glaring evidence of outright fraud generally involve entities that are already gone. So this is one of the most important and essential features of why this business is so susceptible to deception, is that by the time people sort of become conscious of the fact that they've been ripped off, those folks are already safely elsewhere.
Dan, thanks a lot for that call. If anyone else has a question or comment, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. A question that was asked during the mortgage meltdown, and again, Kevin Kinzer, you might respond to it similarly, but shouldn't students do a better job of picking a school, of taking on debt? Isn't there a buyer beware function here that might be hard to get around as well?
Sure. There are steps that students can take to verify that the institution that they're enrolling in has a good program. They should certainly shop around. But there's what we call information asymmetry here. In other words, the provider of the education always knows much more about it than the person who's purchasing it. It's not like you can say, oh, I'm going to take this education, then I know immediately that it's flawed. You don't know until you get out and try to use it. We don't have a lemon law, for example, in education like you do for buying a car, where if you have a certain amount of time to return it, no questions asked. You're in it, you pay in advance for something, and you might not know for years whether what you got is worth the price that you paid or worth anything at all.
What are we talking about when we talk about the accreditation criteria that were in question for ITT? Barmak Nasirian, can you talk about that?
Sure. We have a process of quality assurance as a condition of institutional participation in federal financing, and that process is delegated for perfectly sound reasons to non-governmental entities on the theory that we don't want politicians or civil servants to intrude on academic judgment. You don't want politicians in this country to vote about, I don't know, global warming or evolution or lots of other things. So the notion is that there will be a rigorous process of peer review by which the quality of the service that is being offered is judged to be above a certain threshold. But the challenge there is that with regard to certainly for-profit, lots of important historical elements that made that peer review process rigorous are missing and nobody noticed. I mean, one of the most important issues is the presence of a qualified, tenured faculty that controls academic policy. In the case of for-profits, the boss controls academic policy. With regard to ITT, I noticed about 10 years ago that you had to traverse 3 financial aid years at ITT because of their credit requirement to get an associate's degree.
And Versus two in most public universities.
The norm is 2. But they did it that way. And this was all about the number of academic credits you had to earn. But they designed it that way to maximize the cost and maximize eligibility for financial aid. That's not something that Kevin would ever get involved in as a tenured professor at Penn State. You know, that's a business office decision at most, and Kevin would have complete say over academic requirements for a degree from Penn State, Kevin and his colleagues. So there are significant elements missing, and when you mentioned the mortgage crisis, mm-hmm. or the meltdown of structured credit back in 2008, the accreditors, certainly in this space, but candidly, I apply this to all accreditors, are culpable the way the ratings agencies were with regard to securitization, in that we delegate to them a technical judgment. And it's really astonishing to see the vaporware that masquerades as academic content being offered by some of these institutions. It's the accreditor's job to catch these, and frankly, they have not done a good job at all.
Well, what kind of liability is built into the system, Kevin Kinzer, for the accrediting agencies?
Right. Well, the agencies, in order to serve as this gateway to federal financial aid, have to be approved by a committee that's part of the Department of Education. Mm-hmm. And so they have to report on certain aspects of their performance and meet the criteria that the department has. The department actually is raising questions about whether to continue authorization for the accreditor of the main accreditor for ITT and several other for-profits in a very big statement about what they're going to do to hold accreditation responsible.
Is that the Accrediting Council for Independent Colleges and Schools?
That's the accreditation agency for ITT, yes.
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh no! So I was just saying that that's a formal review process on another basis. They rely on their membership in order to justify their activity. So BARMAC calls them non-governmental, but they're a non-governmental voluntary membership organization. So the people that are evaluating ITT are other for-profit institutions and executives and staff from those institutions who are providing their own standards associated with it. So the possibility exists for these schools to develop a buddy relationship with other for-profits and approve their programs if their programs are going to be approved. It can be quite a difficult scenario when you find yourself in a role that's supposed to be an autonomous evaluation system, a quality assurance system, but it's actually been captured by the entities it's supposed to evaluate.
Right. I mean, ultimately, you don't want to oversee your way out of a job. If they were tougher on schools like ITT, eventually there wouldn't be enough of them around to...
You know, to put it bluntly, okay. It's become a race to the bottom.
Huh.
It's become very much the way ratings agencies began to compete on the basis of how readily they would qualify securities as AAA. We have ended up, unfortunately, precisely because of the dynamic that Kevin articulated, with agencies whose rubber stamp, frankly, implies almost nothing about the quality of what is being sold for tens of thousands of dollars.
So, all right, if accreditation was a question for ITT, what about the rest of them? I mean, the same accrediting council for independent colleges and schools has oversight of several remaining Columbus area schools: American National University, the Bradford School, Daymar College, Harrison College, Hondros College of Business, Miami Jacobs Career College, and Ohio Business College. I mean, what about the rest of them? Are they all brought into question?
Well, what's going on is if this accreditation agency gets its authorization pulled by the Department of Education, those schools you just named are going to have to find another accreditation agency in order to continue participating in the federal financial aid. The question becomes what legitimate accreditation agency is going to want to take a risk on those institutions now that they've been associated with a failed regulatory process through the quality assurance of ACICS, the accreditation agency. But I mean, I don't think that we should be thinking. I mean, we have to remember that there are real students involved here,
right,
who are caught up in this through essentially no fault of their own, that are trying to better their lives and get an education. And you know, we shouldn't be doing a victory lap about this. We should be trying to figure out how do we make sure that the institutions that students are choosing are not have a level of quality associated with them, so students are actually able to get value for the resources, time, and money that they're putting into their education. And when those things fail, we ought to have policies that really have a way of holding those students harmless as much as possible for the horrible situation that they now find themselves in with debt, no program, and no opportunity for transfer of credits.
Well, Kevin Kinzer, let me ask you this from where you sit at Pennsylvania State University, you know, a highly ranked, you know, public university. What's missing in the matrix of higher education in the United States that drives these students to these kinds of places?
Well, so the idea that students are making rational choices about where to go, and I'm not saying this pejoratively, that they're actually weighing the pros and cons of different institutions, looking at the information that's available and making the best choice possible for them. Most students are not making decisions along those ways. They're making decisions about where to go to school at the same time they're making the decision to go to school, and often it's the school that's right in front of them. Look at where the institutions are advertising, and you'll identify where the target market is for those institutions. What the for-profit sector had historically been responsible for is lower-level career training, non-degree certificate programs, areas where most public institutions were not participating, being focused, an institution like Penn State, primarily on degree-granting programs.
Mm-hmm.
What we saw over the last 15 or 20 years is the for-profit sector getting more and more involved in degree-granting institutions, and that's really not where the capacity demand, capacity need really is. The for-profits are really important when it comes to non-degree programs. We have capacity in the degree level to be able to handle what the students are that are making the choices to go to for-profits. And I think it's a matter of getting traditional institutions to focus their recruiting efforts on bringing in students from populations that have traditionally not been looking for them and looking for those students to bring them into a quality education environment.
Well, Kevin Kinzer, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Kevin Kinzer, education policy professor at Pennsylvania State University and expert in for-profit education. And Barmak Nasirian, thanks to you as well. I appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
Barmak Nasirian is Director of Federal Relations and Policy Analysis at the American Association of State Colleges and Universities. Coming up, we're going to hear from a former dean of academic affairs at the ITT Technical Institute here in Columbus on the Eastside campus, and also a dean of students at Franklin University, where they're trying to help some of these stranded students resettle. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Thank you.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. For-profit and private ITT technical institutes closed their doors across the country for good last week. The move came about 2 weeks after the Department of Education barred the parent company from enrolling new students using federal financial aid funds. That's left about 45,000 students across the country without a school. We're going to talk about what happens to them. Joining us by phone is Lynn Hull, Dean of Students at Franklin University. Lynn is helping resettle some of the students at Franklin. Welcome to the show, Lynn.
Thanks, Ann. I really appreciate the opportunity to chat with you.
Also, the former Dean of Academic Affairs at ITT Technical Institute's Columbus Eastside Campus, Michael Traina. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Ann. Appreciate it.
Michael Traina, you're out of a job now, along with thousands of other instructors, teachers at ITT institutes across the country.
That is correct.
How did you find out that ITT was closing and that you would lose your job?
We knew when the department about 3 weeks ago, issued the new restrictions about new federal funding, that this was a possibility. The company put out a notice on the Friday before Labor Day, that'd be the second, that everyone should take Tuesday after Labor Day off, and they would have a response at that point. That Tuesday morning, all the employees received an email saying your job has been permanently eliminated, and you can come pick up your stuff later in the week.
It's not hard to find ITT students who are dissatisfied with the school. What concerns did you have that things weren't going right? Right before Labor Day that you found out things weren't going right?
No, I mean, all the things I knew that weren't going right were mostly, you know, corporate finance stuff. And I think most former ITT employees or, you know, the folks who were there at the end would tell you that at the schools, most of the employees did a great job. They really had the students' concerns and well-being in mind. The issue was some of the corporate policies and a handful of bad actors who didn't. The running joke, and I was with ITT for 14 years, the running joke at the campuses was that the schools are great, the corporation is terrible.
Right. As someone referred to, it was the bosses at the top. Yeah. About 2,000 or so Ohio students are looking for alternatives after the ITT shutdown. How were they informed of the shutdown, Michael Traina?
They also received an email from the department and then from ITT as well, and that's it. There was no further communication. I heard from students, at my personal cell phone, some of the ones who happen to have my number, students call me when they saw me on the news cleaning out my office. I mean, literally, that's how some of them found out if they hadn't checked their email. It was that sudden.
Is anyone left at ITT to answer questions and help direct students to alternatives?
As of right now at the campuses, no. All of the campuses are permanently closed as of yesterday. Mm-hmm. I actually talked to my former boss, and she was the last one there as of yesterday. There are still folks at the corporate offices, from what I understand, and students can still get information from the website.
Lynn Hull, as Dean of Students at Franklin University, how much were you paying attention to all of this before the shutdown actually occurred? Was this something you were being warned about at all?
Well, you know, we were aware immediately when the Department of Ed came in and took that action that they did about a week prior.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that there's been conversation related to Corinthian colleges
which shut down last year, right?
Right, right. So, you know, that's sort of on the radar. But when we didn't anticipate, I don't think that the shutdown would happen as quickly as it did.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as we actually had an event on campus last night to talk with some of the displaced ITT students. And I think, you know, some of the things that we were seeing on their faces and hearing in their words were, you know, there was sort of this sense of shock. But also, I would say, Anne, what was so heartwarming about it was the spirit of hopefulness and determination. These are a group of people who really are committed to their education and are just looking to try to find the best path forward.
What can you do to help them, Lynn Hull?
So, you know, there are a number of things that we at Franklin University tried to rally. Keep in mind, Anne, that we're a nonprofit university that specializes in transfer students. So we didn't have to gyrate around to try to figure out how to accommodate these students. It was just a matter of what special things might we be able to do to be helpful, knowing their specific circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
So we really have come up with two major things that we are able to do. There's a third one that it looks like it's being necessary as well. So the two major things that we're doing for our ITT students We're encouraging them to come in, and we're going to be able to do their initial course with us at Franklin University. It's called a Learning Strategies course. It's the first course you take with us, a 2-credit-hour course. We're doing that for no cost at these students. It's a required introductory course. It's designed to help students transition smoothly into our university because in many cases our students are coming from other institutions. So this is a good, strong start to Franklin. So we're doing that for our ITT students at no cost. And then the second major thing that we're able to do is we're reducing our residency requirement. And I was telling some friends about this, so I want to be clear. It's not that they have to live on campus for a shorter period of time. It's an academic residency requirement. So, for example, typically if a student wanted to complete a Franklin degree, you can't just come in and take one class and call yourself a Franklin graduate.
Uh-huh.
So our residency, in other words, the courses that you would have to take at Franklin to be called a Franklin graduate with an associate degree, that's typically 20 hours. But we are going to be able to allow those students who are pretty far down the track to complete 12 hours with us for that associate degree. And we typically require a minimum of 30 hours for a bachelor's degree, but we're going to be able to accommodate those ITT students who are pretty far along with only 16 hours to complete their bachelor's degree with us, depending upon their degree requirements and what they're transferring in. And there's one last thing that we're able to do. We heard last night from the students that they are having trouble getting their transcripts from ITT. And so typically we require official transcripts to be into Franklin prior to a student getting started with us.
Yeah.
And so what we're doing is we're allowing students, and they did it last night at our event, they're bringing in their unofficial transcripts, and our transfer credit team is taking a look at that so that we can help them to determine best fit programs. And then we're going to allow them to turn in their official transcripts to us by the end of our fall term, which is in December.
Typically, what would you take in transfer credits from ITT?
So Franklin has a long history of pretty robust transfer with many institutions. And so what we did prior to these events that we've been hosting, the one that we had last night and the one that we're doing tonight down in Dayton at our Beaver Creek campus, is we asked our transfer credit folks to go back and look at what we had long been bringing in from ITT and just do a quick refresh based upon their current catalogs and make sure that every single possible thing that we can bring in from ITT is in our repertoire to be able to bring over. And our transfer team did an analysis of ITT programs that are particularly friendly to come over to Franklin
uh-huh.
in order to have our students be able to finish as quickly as possible. And we created a web page at franklin.edu/ITT, and we've identified, I think, 3 associate degrees that are particularly friendly for transfer to Franklin. And then, let's see, I think there are maybe 8 or 9 baccalaureate degrees.
Are any other local universities, colleges or universities, doing anything like what Franklin is? Do you know, Lynn Hull?
They are. So, for example, we work very closely with Columbus State.
Yeah.
So Columbus State is absolutely reaching out to these students. And then we received some information that some of our partners down in the Dayton area, I know that Sinclair was doing something, I think Clark as well. So what's really heartwarming is the entire state's trying to, you know, see what we can do collectively and allow students to just find the best, you know, the best fit for them. So everybody's trying to rally to see what we can do to help these folks out.
Is Franklin comparable in cost to ITT?
You know, I don't know exactly what their tuition rate is, and I can tell you that Franklin's undergraduate tuition rate is $494 per credit hour. So, and you know, I think you know one thing to remember is with our really friendly transferability, we're able to be really helpful to students because hopefully they won't have too much to complete. One of the things that the students were telling us last night is, gosh, I don't want to have to start over.
Yeah.
Don't want to have to take things that I've already taken or repeat things. And so that's a real advantage that Franklin has, because transfer is really what we do best.
What about funding options for them? A very high proportion of them were probably on financial aid if the research stands.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. We had our financial aid folks with us last night, and they were having a lot of conversations with students. What we're encouraging them to do, because Franklin, again, this is sort of what we do, we serve this adult transfer market, we have several starts within each trimester. So students who might be really interested in being aggressive about, you know, getting started this fall, they can get started with us on September 26th. And then they could still at least receive part-time status, and part-time status enables them to receive federal financial aid. So there are some options. But, you know, for folks who really want to try to make that happen, you know, we're already at September 15th. So
right.
We're trying to help them to move quickly if that's what they want to do. We do have a November start as well. Mm-hmm. And since that we're able to do that initial course at no cost for students, students could theoretically with us get started in November
Okay. And
then have their financial aid in place for January.
Michael Trena, yeah. I mean, does this? What are you telling students who do contact you? How are you trying to help them?
There's a couple things I've been telling them. One is, of course, as far as transcripts, I don't have a good answer for that.
Isn't there some obligation on the part of the company to at least provide transcripts?
There is, but there's not really a time frame about that. So, Yes, they have to get transcripts, and eventually you'll be able to get them probably from the state board. But there's no, you
no
there's
way
nothing
to do
that says
it now.
If you request it today, I have to give it to you today.
Gotcha.
So, yes, they will be able to get them eventually. I really appreciate what Franklin's doing as far as letting people come in with an unofficial, giving them some time to get the officials, because I think that's the right thing to do. And well, I've always been really appreciative of how great they are about taking our transfers when some other schools won't.
At least one program completed classes on August 31st, I understand, according to a report in the Dispatch. But as of last week, they hadn't been able to get information about graduation. And Michael Trena, I was told you're working on making something happen.
We are. Actually, we do have a venue tentatively booked for October 2nd. So we backed up a couple of days for the graduation. It's not going to be an official ceremony, but it's at least something where the students can come in, put on their caps and gowns, get pictures taken, have their families clap for them. Something that myself and a couple other former employers are doing basically at our own expense and our own time. But it's the right thing to do for the students, and that's what matters to me.
You know, Lynn Hull is Dean of Students at Franklin University, and at that meeting last night, I'm sure you heard, I mean, you know, education, someone who's actually reached out and tried to get an education like that, anyone, it's an emotional thing. You must have heard some stories.
We did. And you know, I think it was, there were students with us and last night who were everywhere on the journey. There were some who literally were getting ready to start their first class when they received the email. There was a gentleman that we spoke with last night who was supposed to graduate in December. And everywhere in between. So I'm so appreciative of the effort that's being made to help those students who were supposed to actually complete, be able to mark that milestone in some formal way. So just, Michael, thank you for doing that. I think, you know, the students that we spoke with last night, they are hopeful. They were also, I would say, they were appreciative just about our having transparent conversations with them. Mm-hmm. They just said, you know, tell us where we are and you know, what our path forward should be. And, you know, we were really sort of saying, we're here to help. And, you know, we want those students to find the best place for them. So if that's Franklin, that's wonderful. If that's somewhere else, we absolutely want to encourage them to just do their research and make the best decisions to help them move forward.
Is there any clearinghouse number that you can give to them? Anything general, or is it on an institution-by-institution basis?
I think, you know, a lot of the institutions, the ones that I mentioned previously, have put up web pages that are specific for those students.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing that I would mention is I believe ITT is working with Parchment because that transcript piece is pretty important.
Mm-hmm.
So Parchment is sort of a transcript aggregator, And it sounds like they can request those official transcripts through Parchment. And Parchment, we work with them all the time. They typically have a pretty quick turnaround,
okay.
But they are sort of setting the expectation that with sort of the glut of requests that are coming
yeah.
in, because you know, it's coming in from across the country, they
right.
are saying a few weeks.
Okay.
And we were hearing students say that that was the message that they were receiving as well.
And Lynn, I'm sorry to interrupt, but that's what I heard the other day as well,
okay.
that they are working with Parchment, but it's going to be a little bit of time before that's up and running.
Yeah, that's what we're hearing too. So that sounds like it's correct.
Lynn Hull, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Oh, I really appreciate being here. Thank you so much.
That's Lynn Hull. She's Dean of Students at Franklin University. Also, Michael Traina, thanks to you.
Thank you.
Michael Traina, he's the former Dean of Academic Affairs at the ITT Technical Institute Columbus Eastside Campus, now shut down along with all of the campuses for ITT across the country. Thanks a lot for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.